Did you miss me?
I know I did. I had the chance to sit down with Dr. Stephen Parrish. Dr. Parrish is the professor of philosophy at Concordia Ann Arbor. He wrote a book called Atheism, which questions the underlying assumptions of the atheist worldview. It is so far a very good book. By the time of this interview, I had not yet finished it, which I was very disappointed in myself. However, I am getting closer to that goal and will be posting a review as soon as I have done so. It was wonderful to sit down with Dr. Parrish because we were able to speak about philosophy and Christianity and atheism and how we view the world. I was very out of my depth for the conversation. Dr. Parrish is a brilliant man, and I am not very smart. But I had such a lovely time. He's such a gracious and wonderful man, and I hope you really enjoy this interview. I hope you enjoy the chat we had, because I enjoyed it, and I hope that he will agree, if this wasn't too bad of an experience for him, to come back on sometime. So with all that being said, I guess you know the deal. Let's hit that bump music. So I want to thank you for accepting the invite to be on the podcast. It means a lot. It means a lot to have you here. I'm enjoying your book so far. I'm sad to say I haven't finished it yet, but I'm enjoying it so far. So you say right up front in your book that people assume sort of naturalism and atheism like as the default.
Well, yes, among academics, not among normal people, but academics and that kind, the people who are the chattering class, so to speak, as they sometimes say. It is in the university. It's not a specifically Christian one.
I notice it among normal people, too.
Yeah.
There is sort of a duality where they have... on the one hand, they take the, this world is all there is. But on the other hand, they, I go to church and, I believe in God. But it's all, to them, God is all very sort of far off, you know. And it's not, that's good and well to do on a Sunday. But for the day-to-day, the here and now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, whatever ideas he has arranged and start out in academia, they begin to flow down among the rest of society. It's sort of like Francis Schaeffer's bifurcated reality. Have you heard that? That simply on the lower level you have normal life and science and all reason, this kind of thing, and on the upper level there's the just faith and God and mysticism and things like that, and the two levels are disconnected with each other, and that is the way I think a lot of people do think.
Yeah.
Of course, again, in academia, it has a tendency to just get rid of the upper level entirely. Mm. So.
Well, and it's sad too to disconnect the two things, because people, they miss out. They're missing out on so much.
Oh, I totally agree, but. Go ahead.
I mean, just know that's it. There's so much to faith and life, and I don't know, living life, I guess, in faith, right? And there's so much comfort and assurance and help and I don't know, people, they miss that entirely.
Well, yes, and they do miss it, and they try to come up with substitutes for it. Mm-hmm. Some of the more bizarre ideas that are running through our society are an attempt to come up with a substitute religion, so to speak.
Yeah.
One based on this world, where people can save themselves by creating a perfect society, and they do that by changing all the laws that God has made and trying to attempt to change human nature. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, they, you know, that has been a very popular idea, but it's basically a religious one.
It is. It is. And it's the idea. I wonder how they deal with things, because there's this idea that people are basically good. And that seems to be the modern society's sort of idea, that people are basically good. And so then they have to go, they have to really sort of take the long way around to figure out why bad things happen, right?
Yeah. Yes. I think that's an assumption they make. They're, people are naturally good. They are naturally good. You know, they're not perfect, they think, but they're naturally good. And then you have the problem of why is the world such a mess? I think one reason why Marx was so popular among those on the left and among the utopians is simply he did provide a way, an explanation, not a very good explanation in my opinion, but why the world was so messed, because he thought starting out at primitive communism that we had to go through all these stages before we come to mature communism, and that meant private property, and for him private property was basically, well, the root of all evil in a sense. But we had to go through it. But you know, I don't think it's a very good explanation for several reasons, but you're right. People want to think themselves as being good, and if people are good, and if people are not good, if they're inherently flawed creatures, then you can't create a utopia.
Right.
Utopia is a substitute for heaven, mm-hmm. for a lot of these people.
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand. I try to understand their mentality, but I do so from the outside, because I've never been had any sympathy for these kind of views.
It's funny, their idea of utopia, when they try and enact it in any place we've seen in history where they've tried to sort of push this ideal, it invariably ends up a horror show, just an absolute horror show. It's almost, it's like, so I heard a Lutheran pastor say that the reason things like vampires and zombies and all this capture the imagination in horror is because they mock the truth of the resurrection. And it's almost like this, when we try and make utopia on earth, we end up, instead of creating heaven, we end up sort of mocking it with this horrible, sinful kind of thing, right?
Yeah. No, you're right. They always end up in major disasters with millions of people dead and economies ruined and other things. But, you know, the thing is, even the utopias that they described, even if they could be reached, they actually sound pretty boring to me.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my biggest fears growing up was heaven, actually heaven, because the way it was described, I grew up sort of vaguely Protestant, and the way heaven was described was sort of like that communist utopian ideal. And I was like, so we're just going to sit around all the time? You know, like, what do we, everything's just provided and, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't know what heaven's going to be like exactly, but I think it's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
One thing I know, you know Isaac Asimov,
mm-hmm.
the great science fiction writer?
Yes.
He was an atheist. And one place I remember reading, he said, well, you know, this world is it. And he says, would heaven be okay? Well, you know, you get these wings and everybody just stands around on clouds, and flying would be good, and then smiling purely at all the ladies. But it'd be boring after a few days. In other words, he was taking the cartoon mm-hmm. version of heaven as being actually what it would be like.
Yeah. Well, and God, it's kind of important to note, created work and duty and all this stuff sort of prior to the fall, right?
Yes.
So why wouldn't these things be incorporated into heaven? Adam had a job prior to the fall. Why wouldn't
right.
we? There's going to be, you know, there, we have to have something to do. Work.
Yeah, just sitting around and being, you know, playing and harps. Just
playing harps on the clouds, yeah. Not going to work. I tried. I thought it would be fun. I thought it would be fun to find some ridiculous memes put together by high school and college kids that think they're so smart and run them by you. but I couldn't find any that were worth, that were honestly worth anything.
Yeah.
But I thought maybe some fun, like, young people atheist arguments to see how you would feel about them. But honestly, they were, like, one, I've read one where this guy said, well, the reason we should have no religion in government is because we saw this happening before with religious clergy running the government, and they were so corrupt, so we booted the clergy out, as though, like, religion were the problem and not, you know, people.
Yeah. Whoever you're going to have in power, you're going to have corruption.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You can do things to modify it or whatever, but it's going to be there. And sometimes it's getting worse. I think it's getting pretty bad right now.
It is.
So
it is. Why do you think people aim that at religion and specifically at the church? Why is religion the problem?
Well, for some people, I don't know, they may have had a bad experience with church or religion. I've read, I'm not sure about this, that Richard Dawkins was sexually abused at an Anglican school by one of the teachers there. Now, he may well have become an atheist if nothing had ever happened, but he probably wouldn't have become such a militant, outspoken, really annoying atheist as he has become. Yeah, some people have bad experience with church, but also you get the idea, especially if you go into college, and most colleges, not the one I teach at, Concordia, Ann Arbor, and Mequon, that all the cool people are atheists or something, like agnostics or something. All the cool people are materialists. If you're religious, you're just an old fogey, or you know, you're just not in with the in crowd. And I really don't know how many people who lose their religion in high school, in college or wherever, really have been honestly argued out of it. I think it was just, a lot of it's just peer pressure.
Yeah.
And I even read an article in a scientific magazine about 20 years ago. I don't think some things have changed. So, yeah, one was, of course, why do people become atheists? Well, one reason, of course, because we're so smart. That's one. Of course, that is very tendentious right there. But the other one is, being honest, is, yeah, because that's what expected. You know, it's expected to go into some of these programs. You're going to be an atheist, or at least an agnostic or secularist in some sense. And, you know, I think that's it. Peer pressure cannot be underestimated, especially among young people, but among older people too.
Yeah, there's also a lot of not just peer pressure from your peers, right? But also, like, from your professors and whatnot. They expect you to, and that's the joke in college, right? Is that you don't have to write a good paper. You just have to write a paper that your professor likes.
Yeah.
You know, and how many people end up doing that, you know, writing this, you know, paper. I had to, so my undergrad is at Liberty University, which is firmly Baptist, and I had to write a whole paper on, like, dispensationalist eschatology and why the temple has to be rebuilt and sacrifices reinstituted before Christ can come back and all this. I had to write a paper on this in the pre-tribulation rapture, none of which I believe.
Right.
Right. And I had to write a whole paper on it. And it was tricky to do honestly, you know?
Right. Yeah. So, and, you know, yeah, sometimes students do write to please their professors, but in papers. But again, especially in grad school, there's this atmosphere. But yeah, it's also soaking down into society too.
It is. It's disheartening to see. It's disheartening to see young people that see a meme by some, like, okay, say, like, Ricky Gervais is, I think, the perfect example of this. Do you know who Ricky Gervais?
The name is familiar, but I don't know.
He's a comedian.
Oh, okay.
He's the guy that wrote and starred in the original UK version of The Office back in, like, the 90s.
Okay.
And that's it. He's a comedian. He's a comedian, but he's also an outspoken atheist. And he makes atheism funny and so people believe it. I don't understand like how exactly it works, because none of his arguments are that effective to me. So he talks about one of his things is, oh well, there's tens of thousands of gods, Dr. Parrish, and you don't believe in any of those. I just believe in one less god than you. That's stupid.
Yes,
that's dumb.
It's a terrible argument, but I keep on hearing that meme. You know, I have a friend, a former student, J.W. Wartook, who has the website, Always Have a Reason or something, and he told me he's constantly running into that from atheists. It's a really stupid argument.
It is, but they're so proud of it. They think, oh, this is so good. You know, how to checkmate fundies, you know?
I mentioned that in the book. I mean, it's not all highbrow in the book. I try to mention some things that are basically out there I've noticed on the internet. Have you gotten that far in the book, may I ask you?
I've not. I'm through probably a third of it at this point.
Okay.
So, how do you feel, since you brought it up earlier, Richard Dawkins in general, Dawkins, Hitchens, this sort of, I guess they call it like the new atheist sort of school. I've read through some of their works and have never been really too thoroughly impressed.
I only read one of his books a long time ago and I wasn't all that impressed, but I tend not to avoid tend to avoid talking about the science because I don't know about it. I only like to talk about things I actually know something quite a bit about. But I can tell you this, as a philosopher, he has no idea what he's talking about. Mm. You know, maybe he's the world's greatest biologist. I kind of doubt it. I currently doubt it. But even if he were, it doesn't mean that he knows what he's talking about philosophically.
Yeah.
And a lot of this is because science has such a such prestige these days. Mm-hmm. You know, because it does all these wonderful things, bad things, some bad things too, unfortunately, but mainly wonderful things. People have the idea that if you're a scientist, you must be an expert on everything. But of course, that's not true, right?
Right. I have long thought. I first started studying apologetics some time ago, and maybe 2 or 3 years ago, like really studying sort of different apologetic arguments, and very quickly realized that the philosophical arguments both for and against God are much more compelling than I think the scientific ones. You know, we can talk about fine-tuning all day long, but, you know, I don't know, though.
Well, I agree with you. I think philosophy is more compelling than scientific. And that's one reason I'm in philosophy. But I mean, I'm not saying that all scientific argument is bad, but I stick to what I know. And, you know, when I first went to grad school at Wayne State in Detroit, and I don't remember exactly, this was nearly 40 years ago, but talking to Dr. Bruce Russell, who later became my doctoral dissertation advisor, director, whatever, and is still a friend. And he is a committed atheist, and he says, well, you know, we're atheists because something like this. There are no good arguments for the existence of God, and the problem of evil provides a powerful argument against God. Now, that's the way that they tend to think about it. And I think partly because of me that I started bringing in a lot of theistic arguments. And, you know, the heart of my book is theistic arguments for the existence of God based on philosophy. And I wrote my doctoral dissertation defending one of them, trying to show, you know, and I got it through, even though I think three out of the four people, of the original four on the dissertation committee, three of them were atheists or agnostics. So, you know, the thing is, it's not true. I think there are a lot of good arguments for the existence of God. Mm-hmm. Some are better than others, but
I don't know how to phrase it. I don't know how to phrase it, but you phrased it the best, which is just because you have a theistic worldview doesn't mean it's like intrinsically irrational, right?
No.
That's sort of the opening volley that you give there, and it's such a good point. It's not something that we think about, but we do so often just immediately write people off because of their presuppositions or our presuppositions about their worldview.
Yeah.
you know, I do want to ask you the problem of evil. Since you brought it up, I actually had this one written down for you. The problem of evil. Is it a problem?
Is it a problem? Yes, it's a problem on several levels. In part of the book, a chapter, I don't know, 5 or 6, something like that. I should know my own book better, but I talk about it. And, you know, there's an awful lot of horrible things have happened in the world. You know, the bubonic plague, which wiped out a third of the population of Europe or something, and World War and child abuse and all sorts of things, terrible things. And a priori, you know, before experience, you probably think, if there's a perfectly good God, would he create a world with this much evil, or any evil in it? Some philosophers have said that such a God would be incompatible with any evil. I don't think that's generally held to be true now, but a lot of philosophers, like Bruce Russell, say that there's just too much evil in the world. And, you know, I don't know exactly why there's so much evil in the world, and especially when you get down to individual acts of evil, right? You know, God had to have a perfectly good reason for allowing so much evil to exist. Doesn't mean we know what it is, right? So, in the book, I just say, you know, if God was going to create the human race and let them do their thing, so to speak, and try it, you're going to get a world like this. Because contrary to what so many of the people say, people are not naturally good. Right. There's good in them, but it's all combined with evil.
Yeah.
And I think that's a large part of it. A lot of the answer. You remember a year or two ago, there was a couple that were going to take a bike ride around the world to show that people were naturally good. They said that they were going to do that. You remember that?
I remember a woman backpacking through the Middle East for a similar reason, and she didn't make it very far.
No, these two people were trying to show that people are naturally good. They're myopic sometime and dumb, but you know they're basically good. They were murdered by the Taliban or ISIS. It's not funny, but yeah. in Central Asia, right? It's not funny, but you know it just. You know, I don't understand how people can believe that people are naturally good, even if they've had kids. And my kids were actually pretty good. You know, they were pretty good.
I had a coworker tell me the other day. They said, "Oh, well, people are naturally good. It's sort of society that is evil and drives people to do evil things because there's disparity in society. You know, there's systemic racism and there's all this other stuff in it. It drives people to do evil." And I said, "Well, if people are naturally good, how did society get evil?"
Yeah, and that's
where's the corruption come from?
Yeah, and you know we've had all sorts of societies. In many ways, our society is more fair or even more egalitarian than just about any society in history. I mean, most societies in history have had like a ruling class, a slave class, and you know it doesn't make any sense, and that's why I brought up Marx, because he tried to come up with some sort of explanation. I don't think it succeeded. But the other thing I want to say about the problem of evil is, does atheism have a problem of evil? And you have to read the book to understand what I'm talking about. What are the odds, a priori, given atheism, that there's going to be evil in the world or so much evil? Now, what do I mean by this? The main argument of the book is simply this. Can I start?
Yeah, please.
Okay. God is conceived of, and I believe to be, a necessary being. I mean a being who exists in all possible worlds. Of course, for a lot of heroes, they might not know that either. But you know, this is what philosophers talk about all the time. Possible worlds, put simply, is simply reality as it could have been. All right. So just that as 2 + 2 = 4 is necessarily true, and therefore true in all worlds, no matter what else is true. God exists. That's what theists think, that God exists. And why does this world, why do we have this world, you know, instead of one where, you know, you could say where you would be rich instead of so good looking, you know, why do we have this world? Well, God has a reason to create this world. We certainly don't know all of it, but, or most of it actually, but God chose to actualize, that is, make real, create this world, okay? So we have here the necessary being, all the worlds he could have created, and he chose to create this one. And by world, again, it's not just mean a planet. I mean the whole of reality.
Right.
Now, on the atheist side, you have two options. The first option is that everything is necessary, that this universe is necessary. Nothing could have been different than it is. The problem with this is basically that it's obviously false. Because there's no contradiction in saying, for example, that my pencil over there could have been 2 inches to the left or something, and everything else be it. In other words, there's this, it to be necessary, you have to deny, a denial of it has to be contradictory. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's one atheist thing. It's not the most popular. The most popular is simply chance. Now, the thing is with chance is, there's all these possible worlds that could have existed, and just for no reason, simply because something had to be, this is the world that was actualized. Okay? It, out of the infinite number of possible worlds, conceivable worlds, ours just by for no reason at all, rather than another one, was the one actualized. A major problem with that is, there are several problems, a major problem with that is, it's not just one fell swoop, so to speak. You know, I take, for example, a proton named Bob. Just named after, right? But Bob is just a little proton somewhere around, right? And Bob exists at noon. Now, if everything exists by chance, why does Bob exists at noon by chance? But I guess, why does Bob continue to exist at 12:01 or 12:02 or 12:03, since there's no reason why he exists? In other words, it's just, in that view, an atheist view, things just appear for no particular reason, and then, but in that case, there should be no order whatsoever. Now, I'm going to say that, given atheism, the odds that you have an orderly universe, first, are remote, very remote. Second, that you have living things in such a universe are even more remote. Third, that you have conscious things in such a universe is even more remote. That things feel, such things feel pain is even more remote. And but at any rate, that there's so much evil in the world. In other words, given atheism, I think the chance of a world like this, given the amount of evil we have, are extremely remote. And we don't know exactly why God allows all the power, all the evil in the world that we see. But it seems to be vastly more likely that there's a God, there's a reason why God has a reason, than the fake thing is basically that the world just appears for no reason at all, continues for no reason at all, and there's all this evil in it.
Right.
Does that make sense? I'm putting it very simply, trying to put it as simply as I can. It's in the book.
It does. It does. It does make sense. It sort of rings of, it's been a while since I've read it. It's on my bookshelf. I want to say on the Incarnation, Athanasius,
mm-hmm.
Where the argument is, why is the universe as it is, as opposed to if it was all chance, not just like a big giant foot, why didn't just like a tremendous eyeball just appear or something like this, you know, like why,
yeah.
Why is it this one thing and not this other thing?
Right.
Why does it have form and function? Why is there purpose? Telos. That's something that.
Why does order continue over time and things like that? Yeah, are you familiar with the Kalam cosmological argument from Bill Craig?
I'm not, no.
He argues that the universe had to have a beginning. And in fact, did have a beginning.
Right.
Things do not just pop out of existence into existence for no reason at all. Therefore, it had to be somebody who could, or something to create it. And of course, he argues that God is the only logical candidate for that. However, in the argument I just gave, it's not just that the universe had to pop into existence at one time that kept on going. It sort of has to pop into existence at every moment it exists, and that applies to every single thing in the universe. All right. So yes, it's personally I think the argument is devastating, but you know you can read it and make your own choice.
That it not just had to begin existing, but that it must continue to exist.
Right, must continue to exist for no reason at all.
Right, and if it could pop into existence for no reason at any time, it could pop out of existence for no reason at any time. So why doesn't it? Is this?
Yes. Can I get my book here?
Yes, please.
It might take me a minute to find this, but go ahead. I'm trying to. I have a quote here from Quentin Smith, an atheist who teaches at least he did at Western New Michigan in Kalamazoo. Let me just a second to find it. Okay, he writes this book. He writes this, and this is from an atheist. I think he may have changed his mind because he realizes how bad it is. But anyway, it is not only all right. Quentin Smith, an atheist, writes about this. At each moment, the world could either happen or not happen. And I marvel that the world happens and continues to happen and voids the possibility of not happening. At each moment, the world holds stands before the abyss of nothingness. But it does not vanish into this abyss. It continues and in so continuing overcomes again and again the possibility of non-existing. It is miraculous, or the other possibility, the possibility of plunging into nothingness is not realized, for this is equally as possible, his own italics, as the possibility that is realized. At every moment, according to Smith, he says, the odds of the universe disappearing into nothing are equal to continue, and yet it keeps on continuing over and over to exist. And he calls this a miracle. And it's... Now, my part is a little bit different because I don't think it's the universe as a whole. It's just individual things that will be popping into and out of existence all the time. Now, he doesn't believe that anymore. He's tried to come up with a way to get around that.
Yeah.
But I don't think it has any more sense than the original. So.
No, and that's a. If I were an atheist trying to make someone an atheist, I think that's a terrible argument.
Oh, he's not trying. Yeah. I think he's being honest there in a way. Yeah. He's not. He wasn't trying to convince people atheists. He's being atheist. He's just a miraculous, but of course that doesn't, for some reason, does not drive him to think, gee, maybe there's a reason why the universe doesn't vanish into abyss, you know?
Right. Well, and you're right. It wouldn't just be the universe as a whole blinking in or out of existence. You're right. It would be, I mean, that would pertain to everything in it.
Yes, we'd be blinking in and out. It'd be total chaos.
It would.
If you had... Yeah, of course. That right now, there are two views on why this world exists with things in it. One of it is if you need a necessary, basically you need a necessary being to actualize it. But if you take that, you've gone in the direction of theism a long way. The other is that there's all these possible worlds. Each one of them is equally likely to be, and ours is just the one that came up. But again, it has to depend on the existence of every single thing in the universe rather than just the universe as a whole. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So the other thing that I find a lot of atheists struggle with beyond random chance,
mm-hmm.
Which if you notice, and this is more on the science-y end, I feel maybe with like Mother Nature, evolution or what have you, but possibly philosophically, like chance is not actually a thing, right? Like chance is it's nothing. It's not a real thing. And yet we ascribe to chance almost consciousness, as though, you know, chance is choosing where we're at.
Right.
And all of this is to sort of overcome, to me, probably one of the bigger problems with atheism in general, and that is purpose. Things have a purpose, and mm-hmm. you can't get a purpose by chance. You don't...
No. Yeah, Aristotle believed that the universe had purpose. Everything in it had its telos, a purpose for it is. But even though he believed in God, apparently he did not believe that God created the world and created everything in it. But he still thought everything had, you know, the purpose of the tree is to grow and have leaves and produce oxygen or whatever, right? And just like the purpose of night to cut, the purpose of a cat is to hunt small prey and sleep 18 hours a day or something, you know? But yeah, you can't have purpose in a chance universe.
Right.
If any order you have is there just by chance. So the lack of purpose is, you know, if you think about the atheist universe, it's really depressing, besides intellectually flawed, because people are here for no reason. Just by chance, you came here for no reason. You're going to be here for a short amount of time, and they're going to be dead, and that's going to be it forever, right? And his life is filled, to be honest, you know, life often is just one stupid thing after another.
Yeah. So then the atheist doesn't have a problem of evil. Evil is perfectly explained in that universe. If this is all there is and it has no meaning and no point and we're here, why not just occupy the time in any way I see fit? And if that is, you know, whatever evil or hedonistic thing I desire, I might as well, because there's no point. So atheism then has a problem of good. Doesn't it? Like, why in a random chance universe where nothing matters, why do people do anything altruistic at all?
Yeah. Well, why is there any good at all besides just existing as, at all? I mean, but the thing is, they want to get rid of God. A lot of them want to get rid of God's purpose and creation so they can have their own. Can I quote here from the book here?
Yeah, please.
Certainly. This is from Eric Fogelin from Enlightenment by Revolution. At the root of the Marxian idea, we find the spiritual disease, the Gnostic revolt. Marx knew that he was a god, small g god, creating a world. He did not want to be a creature. There are a good number of men who want to be gods. They want to be gods and impose their own ideas, their own utopia or heaven on earth. But to get rid of that on earth, but to get to do that, you have to get rid of God in the first place. Because God, well, if God is large and in charge, you're not going to get what you want. So, that's why somebody started when we started talking about this. The idea that, I think atheism is really depressing, like I said. You're here, and you're gone, and some people have short lives and miserable lives. A child has been here for 5 years and they have some leukemia. All right, that's a part of the problem of evil. But the kid's going to be gone forever, and nothing can be done about it, right?
Yeah.
It's even Bruce Russell, my atheistic dissertation director, said atheism's view of man is tragic. But they choose that because they can't stand the idea of there being under the control of a creature who, or not creature, a being who is a lot smarter than they are.
Mm-hmm. And it too, on the theological end, one of the points that we talk about a lot is they're not just escaping control of the supreme being, but then the necessary judgment of the supreme being, right?
Yeah.
And if we can kill God and dethrone him and replace him with ourselves, then who is he to judge us?
Right.
And that's
very widespread. Now, I do want to say that's not the only reason that people are atheists. Some people do have genuine intellectual concerns,
mm-hmm.
Genuine problems. Why does God permit so much evil? But the thing is, there are answers to these things out there if people are willing to look at it with an open mind. But yeah, there are people who have genuine problems. And of course, Christians sometimes, Christians just disagree with each other sometimes. And the church is not perfect.
Mm-mm.
So anyway, that's all I want to say about that. This desire to be God is very widespread. But it's not the only reason that people are atheists.
Has there ever been an atheist argument that you've heard that's given you pause, that's made you think?
No. seriously not. I've read, for example, Michael Martin and somebody else named Ricky, they published two books, The Impossibility of God and The Improbability of God, both thick books full of essays. And I wasn't impressed by either of them. The big problem I have, emotionally anyway, is the problem of evil. When you see something really evil, you say, why does God allow that?
Mm-hmm.
My wife has a friend who lives in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
She's part of a ministry, apparently, that rescues children from, or people who have been sexually sold off, sexually abused, as used for that way. And she was telling about one case where a man sold his 2-year-old daughter to a pedophile so he could get the money to have a tattoo. The child did not survive the night with a pedophile. Now that is a horrible thing.
Yeah.
I mean, so why does God allow things like that? And the answer is I don't fully know. But I think the case for God is so strong that, it overcomes anything like that, momentary doubts. But I've read probably at least 40 or 50 defenses of atheism, and I'm not all that impressed with most of it. Go ahead.
Reading the I think probably the last real book I read sort of defending atheism would have been The God Delusion, by Dawkins.
Yeah.
And, he talks about how his first grievances with the idea of God came in Sunday school when he was a child, and the Sunday school teacher said, oh, well, the sky is blue because God knew that would be pleasing to us and comforting and all this. And then he said, I realized that the reason that that color is has such a calming effect on the mind is because the sky is blue, not the other way around. And it, I don't know, it was very infantile, just sort of right up front, just sort of a silly reason to discard the idea of God altogether. And he's just sort of let that, the rest of the book was just basically him defending the fact that he's let that sort of infantile thought, like, drive him, right? This is, I had this idea when I was 10, and I'm still stuck there on that idea.
Yeah, well, that is pretty infantile. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that some Christians have said silly things at times. The thing is, if one thing, there can be more reason for something, right? If you read a novel, right, and something happens in the novel, right? For example, The Lord of the Rings, where Gollum bites the ring finger off Frodo.
Right.
And then, right, we read that a lot of, it falls in a volcano. Why do you do that? Well, one reason is, of course, because Gollum is a creature obsessed with the ring. He wants it back, you know, because that's what he is. And the other, another reason, however, is that's part of Tolkien's plot, because running out, yeah. So it's not like there's these two viewpoints are mutually exclusive, right? God could create the world because blue is really good for us, and also because he made the world laws of nature such that we're going to have a sky blue sky. So,
yeah. Yeah, it's it's so. People often, in sort of day to day life, maybe not so much in academia, but in day to day life, they are so quick to dismiss the idea of God, and specifically to dismiss Christianity, not because of any rational reason against it, but because the nun at my parochial school was mean, or a bad thing happened to me or to someone I know. And they're so quick to not take God himself. You know, they don't want to take that fight up, but they'll substitute God out for a straw man and then say, well, Christianity isn't true because, you know, Miss Werther didn't know everything in grade school.
Right. People do have, again, I've said unpleasant experiences with the church. Sometimes they've been treated unfairly, of course. Sometimes, you know, there's more than one way of, you know, when you have a dispute, there's two sides to every dispute. Yeah. But yes, people do have, Michael Shermer, who is a foremost atheist, apparently he lost faith in God when one of his friends ended up in an accident being paralyzed from the waist down. Now, being paralyzed from the waist down is a really bad thing, but, yes. You know, again, things like that do not necessitate atheism.
Right.
Right. I mean, you can't blame God for all the evil in the world. And it's actually, in a way, very simple. All right? God would only permit evil if he had a good reason for doing so. Let's assume that, right? Now, if God doesn't exist, then you can't blame God for all the evil in the world, right? Blaming Batman for not stopping a crime wave or something, right? Stupid right. Batman, why doesn't exist? And, you know, stop. Right. But on the other hand, if God does exist, then he does have a morally sufficient reason for creating evil, or allowing evil, whatever. And therefore, that's also not an argument against it. You know, so either way, you can't really blame God for the evil in the world.
So.
Now, go ahead.
How do you bring people around to that?
Oh, I don't know. I'm in books. I read about 100 books a year.
Wow.
Yeah, not all of them are highfalutin of ones, but many of them are, and I'm much more comfortable in writing things and giving lectures at college about things than I am in a one-to-one time. There are people who are at witnessing and giving things at a personal level that are far better than I am. I don't think I have the personal touches as well, as good as many people have. But yeah, how do you bring people around? And I don't think there's any guaranteed way. My sister-in-law teaches at a seminary in Sweden. Because, you know, contrary, you may have heard that not everybody in Sweden is an atheist. But she says friendship. You know, she says the reason is important. Reason is important, but also to get somebody around, friendship is a way to go. You have to, and genuine friendship.
Yeah.
Not just try to manipulate them. And that's, you know, one problem I have with so many Christian films or things. They're manipulative.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, also poor quality.
Also poor quality. Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. And I don't know, we're entering a very weird place, as a society, as a culture, where, we'll take the LGBT thing as an example. I have a lot of gay friends, and there is this unspoken kind of thread or line that maybe I don't really love them or really care for them because I don't wholeheartedly endorse and support every single aspect of their life. And that's such a weird, it's such a weird thing to me. Like, I love my dad with all of my heart. My dad is such a good man, and I respect and admire him, but he's an alcoholic, and I don't support that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I love my dad less.
Right.
And it doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, yeah.
People think you can't have that genuine friendship.
Yeah, they've changed the notion of the very definition of tolerance. Mm-hmm. Tolerance used to mean, I don't like you, or I don't like what you're doing, but I'm going to put up with you, right?
Right.
I don't like this, but, you know, I wish if things were different, but I'm not going to try and force you to change. Nowadays, tolerance has a general idea that, yeah, you have to be enthusiastically affirm whatever the person wants to do. And that, of course, is something entirely different. I don't understand it.
With tolerance specifically, there's a weird doublethink that goes on because people, they use tolerance that way, that you must enthusiastically support. That's tolerance. But then they'll use the word tolerate correctly, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, oh, well, I can tolerate that, I guess, if it gets me to here. And they understand the correct usage of the word.
Yeah, well, it's changing the very meanings of words. By changing the meanings of words, some words, you can start changing how people think.
Mm-hmm.
The tolerance, being tolerant sounds good, which for the most part it is, right? There are some things we don't want to tolerate. But, you know, for the most part, you have to try to be tolerant of people. But if you put tolerance having a somewhat different meaning of it, the natural goodness of the original word might go over to the new concept you're trying to promote. So yes, it's an attempt to change the very way people think.
Very Orwellian.
Words. Yeah, it's Orwellian. You're right.
Yeah.
Out of 1984, Newspeak.
Yeah, that was literally the point of that, right? If we can remove words and change words enough, people can't rebel because they don't have the words to formulate the thoughts to, you know, they just do, you know.
Yeah,
it's a weird world that we're living in.
Yes, I think that's putting it very gently, actually. We're living in insane times.
Yeah. I mean, Clown Town.
Clown Town, yeah.
Yeah, it's Clown Town out here.
The latest thing I heard is that math is racist.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I mean, not maybe the mathematicians are racist. I don't know if that's true, but maybe it's true. Or the way teach math is racist. I don't know if that's true, but it's not impossible. But the very idea that math is racist, it's just totally absurd.
Yeah. Well, I saw an article that denounced white supremacy and racism, systemic racism in the workplace, and up high up on the list of things that are indicative of white supremacy and racism is being punctual and working hard.
Yeah.
Which is just like, that's just like, I feel like if I'm an employer, I just want everyone to be punctual and work hard. I'm going to be punctual and work hard.
Yeah, well, if you're not punctual and work hard, you're not going to be a good worker, and you're not going to get as much done, right?
Right.
You're going to be poor. So yeah. That should be obvious. But see, that's this whole, to change the very structure of reality is what a lot of these people want to do. Mm-hmm. So they can do whatever they want, and everything's going to be great for them. Mm-hmm. They have to substitute change the very nature of reality. Of course, yeah. It's not going to work, but they can cause a great deal of misery in doing so.
I heard Vodi Bakum on, I believe, Issues Etc., talking about the idea of like critical theory and all this, and he said that the goal is to change truth from something objective and outside ourselves to something rather found within the prevailing narrative. And
right.
If we can get people to believe that truth is found in the narrative, then we can push our narrative and change the truth, right?
Right. And that's the way people think. Now, I have to say that doesn't go over a lot with a lot of people in academia. For example, Bruce Russell, I think he hates that way of thinking just as much as I do.
Mm-hmm.
He's sort of an old-fashioned kind of atheist, believing in science and things like that. But so...
I mean, but, you know, does that matter to the people coming up? You know,
I don't know.
Because we're going to leave the world to them eventually.
Yeah, which scares me at the same time. Of course, I won't be here to notice it. But but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I teach college here, and I teach about over 60 students a semester. And I try to teach them straight, you know, that the way the world actually is, and that, you know, math is objective. And yes, if you work hard, you're going to probably do better than if you don't work hard and punctual. And certainly that the Christian view of things makes much more sense than any other view of things.
Yeah. I went to a Protestant Christian private school growing up. And outside of just like making me memorize a chapter of the Bible every week, probably one of the best things it did for me was they taught me how to think. They didn't, a lot of my government classes and science classes and things like that, we were often encouraged to tear things apart and to try and to play the devil's advocate. I had a friend, and me and him would sit and be just downright disruptive with our criticisms in class, playing the devil's advocate, just because it was fun, and we were never punished for that. Mm-hmm. It was always rewarded and encouraged.
Yes,
because you're learning how to think. You know.
Yeah, and that's something you should do: teach people how to think, mm-hmm. not just how to, not just what to think, but how to think. Now, of course, I try to do both, but you know, again, if people just, I tell you, if you disagree with me, you know. Your paper saying Dr. Parrish is all wet, well, you'll be wrong, but I won't mark you down for it.
So what's your favorite part? How long have you been teaching now? What's your favorite part of it?
I've been teaching now for, let's see, about 34 years.
Oh, wow.
Part-time originally, and then, well, it's a long story. Favorite part of teaching is actually, again, when you get students they start talking back to you. I mean, not being rude, but they start asking questions, they're making comments, and even getting in debates and things like that. I don't know if it's just me or what, but it doesn't seem to happen as much as it used to when I first started teaching, that students are much less likely to participate in a class by doing that. I think part of it may be COVID, it might be this COVID thing, and everybody has to wear a mask when they're in the classroom.
All right.
But they just don't see, I don't know if that's just me or if it's a general social trend that students just don't seem to be open up as much.
Well, I think that goes back to teaching people how to think. I don't think the school system focuses anymore on teaching people how to think. I think it's just, here, learn these historical facts. This is how science works. It doesn't matter what your Sunday school tells you. This dinosaur is 72 bajillion years old, and, you know, we're, you know, write this, circled C for the correct answer, and we're moving on here. You know, we got to get you a degree and get you out of here.
Yeah, so. And of course, they also frequently insist on having the right political, social views.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, but
as if there were such a thing as like a correct political or social view. Like my own political and social views fluctuate very wildly depending on what level of government we're talking about, you know? So,
yeah. So, yeah. So you read about a third of the book?
About a third of the way through, I think, yeah.
Okay, I'd be interested in hearing your opinion of it when you finish reading all of it.
I would love to, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and if you can, if you like the book especially, but anyway, you put an Amazon review on.
I will, absolutely. Yeah. And we're going to recommend it here on the podcast as well. So I'm going to include it in the show notes and all that, just so that anyone who listens can link to it.
Yeah, I'd like to, you know, I've talked a lot of depressing things about society rotting and and stupid ideas out there and all this kind of, and all that's true, but I think there are some good signs too. There's an awful, I mean, this right now is the golden age of apologetics.
Mm.
It really is. There are apologetic books coming off the press, I mean, at a great rate. The sad thing is, a lot of people out there don't even know there is such a thing as apologetics.
Yeah.
On the internet, which I try to avoid now, because you meet some very strange denizens of the internet.
Yes.
A couple people on there, one place basically, took for granted that Christians just believe blind faith, no reason whatsoever, and this has been the historic church tradition of the church forever. And that, of course, is simply not true.
Right.
And it can easily found out by not being true. But they seem to be shocked by the idea, no, that's not the way things would be. And people and Christians have offered, you know, a lot of reasons that it's not apart from reason. And they don't, and two of the people just disappeared when they heard that. But you know, I have people who say, well, apologetics, you know, they don't like it for some reason. It's done wrong, which is true sometimes. But I think, you know, we hear a lot of apologetics in the church, or at least some people in apologetics. Out there, a lot of people are just totally oblivious to the whole field.
Mm-hmm.
They have no idea that it even exists, let alone what it consists of. And that is part of the problem. Go ahead.
I think apologetics also goes sort of hand in hand with catechesis, in that a lot of people, both inside and outside of the church, don't actually understand like what Christianity is, right? So they have all these great, on the internet especially, I see a lot of people have a lot of great arguments against a sort of caricature of Christianity. And then you come in and you say, well, actually, we don't believe any of those things at all. If we did, yes, it would be, you're right, we would be very silly. But, you know, you listed all these things that Christians believe are stupid. And I hate to tell you that Christians don't actually believe the things on that list, or at the very, very least, they're, you know, grossly misrepresented.
Yeah. Of course, there really are some Christians out there who do believe silly things.
What can you do?
Yeah. I mean, there are over 2 billion people Christians, or at least nominally Christians.
Yeah.
And that includes, I think, various cults and things.
Yeah.
So over that, you're going to get, and most of them are not educated very well.
Mm.
So you're going to get some strange things. But no, that's not what Christianity itself teaches, a lot of the things.
Right.
But again, you know, there's a very big animus against Christianity in a lot of areas.
Yeah.
People on the internet who are very willing or even eager to believe the worst about, for example, anything American, anything Western, or anything Christian, and yet will bend over backwards to avoid saying anything negative about Islam, for example.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you start talking about these things and they turn into Islamic apologists.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them do. And it just baffles me how they're so willing to think the worst about anything of our own civilization, but at the same time are determined to think the best of another one.
Yeah.
So
I saw a comic to that effect on the internet, where it's these two people on a train, and the guy says to a woman, he says, I see you're headed to work with your girlfriend. You shouldn't be gay. You shouldn't be working. And I want to kill you for showing your hair or something like that. And dressing immodestly. And she says, oh, you must be one of those fundamentalist Baptist bigots. And he says, "No, I'm a Muslim." And she says, "Oh my gosh, your culture is so beautiful."
Yeah. You know? It's strange. I think a large part of the problem, a lot of people really are just ignorant.
Yeah.
And they just, their thoughts are very superficial because they just go with what's ever popular at the moment.
Yeah.
But
And there's also, I think, with the animosity against Christianity specifically, I have to say, you know, the devil is real. And there is going to be necessarily animosity against Christianity. You know?
Yeah.
More specifically than against other things. And you do run across the atheist who says, no, all religion is bad. But if you take a quick scroll through through Reddit, for example, which is a very popular hotspot for liberalism and atheism in general, you will find most of that animosity is targeted specifically towards Christians, as though Christianity is the only religion you can be an atheist from, you know.
Yeah. And
I think that's spiritual to a degree.
Yeah, besides it's just stupid. I mean, but you know, well, they live in a society that was Christian for the most part, still nominally Christian in some ways, partly Christian, and that's what they're rebelling against. But you know, it doesn't. But again, they attack Christians and Christianity for things that are, if they're true at all, they're much more true in other religions like Islam. Mm-hmm. So I mean, people are strange and silly and totally depraved too.
Yes. Any hope for going back? Can we roll it back?
Not in my lifetime. Maybe in yours, possibly. What you have to do is first capture academia. If Christians are to take over academia, and I'm not saying use military force or something like that, but if you can retake academia, then the ideas would start floating down in society and we go back. But until that happens, I don't see there's not much going to happen. I don't see that happening in the near future. I did, for example, I read, you know, somewhere that the philosophers, apparently in North America, I'm not sure, of them 16% are theists. That is 16% of philosophers believe in God. The 70% are atheists and the other 14% are agnostics or something. However, the younger generation, according to us, is now 20% theist. So we're actually making, you know, we're making...
Winning.
Of course, if that happens, and if it keeps on, and it continues, it's going to take a long time. Yeah. But, you know, all you can do is be the best person you can and give the best... And if people have doubts, there's zillions of apologetic books out there.
Yeah.
You know, they're just pile up. I know, because I have a... I own a lot of them. And of course, they don't always agree with each other either. But right. You know, it's
Well, and as our own Lutheran Catechism says, talking about the Apostles' Creed, the third article, I believe in the Holy Spirit. What does this mean? That I, by my own strength and reason, cannot believe. Right. That you know, ultimately. We should have a good defense, as St. Peter tells us. We should be ready and prepared, but you're not going to regenerate someone. You're not going to give them that necessary second birth. That's the Holy Spirit.
No, if I wasn't clear on that, I should be now. You can't save someone by yourself. It takes the Holy Spirit. But you can knock down barriers and make people see things as being more plausible than they used to, right?
Yes.
If it wasn't for the, you know, some people have said apologizing is bad because you're depending on, you know, mere human reason or something. But by the same kind of thing, preaching would be bad.
Yep.
We try to have the best preachers we can, but, you know, again, they can't do the whole job by themselves either, so.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have one last question I want to throw your way, because we're right at an hour here. As far as apologetics and philosophy goes, how do you feel about presuppositional apologetics?
I personally sort of take things from all sorts, right? From different views, evidentialism, presuppositionalism. I would not call myself a presuppositionalist, But I do think they do use the transcendental argument. The argument, the main part of the book, is an adaptation of the transcendental argument, mainly by Cornelius Van Til, who was a presuppositionalist. And also the idea that people do think in terms of systems. Yeah. If you adopted the atheistic materialistic system, that's probably going to influence the way you think about a lot of different things. And therefore, just throwing facts at them without challenging the whole way of their thinking about things may not be that a lot effective. So there's these. So they do have insights into things, but I would not call myself a presuppositionalist, or certainly not at least a pure presuppositionalist.
That's where I ended up sort of landing as well. It's true because people will defend to the death the thing that they already believe, and so a lot of times sort of pushing to the base of that. Well, you know, why are we even? I can throw science facts at you all day long, but you believe the world to be one way, and I believe it to be another way. So these facts are going to be interpreted differently,
right?
You know, and I used to be a lot more into the presuppositional arguments until I hit a college level apologetics class and read through Van Til, and not everything, but I think one book. And there was a lot of where I came away sort of that, you know, there's some good points here, but you can't, I don't think you can rely one way or another just wholly on one kind of argument, right?
It right.
Have to be sort of diverse.
Yeah, you have to be, no, I can't think of the word. But diverse is probably good. You get the arguments from all sorts of views.
Right? Yeah.
And there are historical arguments and, you know, the argument. For example, my friend Gary Habermas, who does teach at Liberty, I've known him for 40 years, believe it or not. He's writing, and he's getting close, I think, to finishing a defense of the historicity of the resurrection.
Oh, that nice.
Yes. He's up to 5,200 pages. Last time I talked to him, about 1,100 pages are done. The rest are 85% done. He's going to have to really, he's going to have to release it in maybe 8 or 9 books. But it's going to be the most thorough defense of the resurrection by far that anybody has ever done. So that's I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. That's wild. I can't, and you know, it's amazing because I can't even fathom. So, forgive my poor knowledge even on the subject, but defense of the resurrection for me is bullet points in my mind. Women were the first people, multiple accounts, seen by over 500 people, personally attested to by the apostles, they were willing to die, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But these are all just sort of like bullet points in my mind. I can't even imagine an encyclopedia's worth of defense.
It's his life works. He's the world's greatest expert on the resurrection probably who's ever existed.
That's
right, other than Jesus, right?
Right.
And he's been studying his entire life, and he's discussing every single aspect of it, including, you know, history of the arguments and life near-death experiences he also talks about, apparently, and other things. So I'm looking forward to reading it, although, you know, 5,000 pages is a lot, but
it's a lot.
I'm looking forward to it.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
Yes.
Very good. Well, Dr. Parrish, thank you so much for agreeing to do this with me. It was truly a great time. Speaking
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.